Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Rouge Rugby Podcast where we talk about real Canadian rugby. I'm Hugh Hardy, joined as always by Derek Brissett. Derek, the Rugby World Cup has come to an end. I know Canada wasn't in it, so we weren't really paying attention, but we did have the bronze and the World Cup final take place this past weekend. You know, two incredibly close games at the end of the day. What did you make of it?
Man, I thought it was excellent. I had a lovely Friday of I went with the method of staying up for it, but I stayed up, watched Canada England, went to sleep kind of during the day, and then woke up to watch England Argentina, and I thought that was a great game. Stoked to see all my Saracen lads get some piece of hardware from the World Rugby at the Rugby World Cup. So I thought that was awesome. Nice to see some of those guys go out on a bit of a high. Side note, I love those alternate Argentina kits. That's a side note entirely, but that was great. That's always good. It's always interesting because it's like the team that wins bronze always seems happier than the team that gets silver. At least they get to end on a bit of a high note. But I thought that was a really good game in England. The main event, though, was New Zealand, South Africa, obviously, with the Springboks going back-to-back World Cup champions. I've realized that since I've started watching rugby, only New Zealand and South Africa have ever won the World Cup. So kind of cool to see them in the final, because it's like the only two teams that I have ever known to actually win World Cups, battling it out with each other. And obviously South Africa becomes the fourth team to win the World Cup. Crazy game. I thought it was I saw some people on Twitter being like it was a really boring game, and I have no idea what game they were watching. It was great. It's a 1-point game. South African rugby is suffocating. Maybe doesn't allow for as much offense. So, I mean, if you want to see some tries, I guess you didn't get that. Obviously, South Africa didn't even score a try in the game that they won. There was a handful of cards in the game, which I felt like just added to the drama. I still hate the review a yellow red card nonsense. Just make a call. Make a call right away. It's weird. I don't like it. But other than that, I thought it was a great game. The All Blacks I thought played great. South Africa played great. There's something about the Springboks though that just, you know, find a way to win three 1-point wins in the knockout stage en route to their record setting fourth World Cup. Man, I thought it was crazy. Well, what did you make of the game?
I thought it was incredibly tense. So as you mentioned, South Africa didn't score a try. New Zealand did. In the four World Cup finals that South Africa have reached, that is the first time they have ever conceded a try.
That's the first time they've conceded. Oh my God.
Back in 95, that was only penalties. Yeah. Back in 2007, that was only penalties as well. 2019, they scored two tries. So that was the first time they scored a try in the World Cup final. This is the first time they've ever conceded.
That's amazing. Well, wasn't 2019 too? Who was it? Was it Mapimpi that scored the first try in 2019? That was like the first time they scored a try. That was the first time that South Africa themselves scored a try.
That's what I said. So,
but they haven't allowed a try in a final?
This is the first time they have. Beauden Barrett is the first player between New Zealand or England, because those are the only two teams that South Africa have faced in the final. He's the only player across all those years and tournaments to have ever scored a try against the Springboks in the World Cup final. So that's an incredible stat.
Yeah, that is an incredible stat. I love that. One of the cool things I thought with this World Cup Finals, I had a couple of my non-rugby friends text me during the game, and they all seemed like they were really enjoying the game. But like, I was trying to explain to like one friend that really liked hockey, that like South Africa kind of plays hockey like the 90s Devils, or plays rugby like the 90s Devils played hockey. And if you're unaware of the 90s Devils as the team with like Scott Stevens, Scott Niedermayer, Marty Brodeur in net, Patrick Eliasch at four, in the forwards, but like, they were just the most suffocating defensive team you could ever possibly play against. Like, you just could not score on them. And many fans, much like maybe some people are looking at this game, fans criticize the Devils for being super boring. But if you ask my New Jersey Devil fans friend, whenever I called his team boring, he'd be like, you know how much fun winning is? And that was his fault. I think ultimately though, like watching South Africa in this World Cup and even in the buildup, the thing I love about South Africa is they're just so unapologetically themselves. Like they play South African rugby, Springbok rugby, in a way that no one else in the world can do it. Right? Like we make like a lot has been made of like the 7-1 split on the bench, and like it worked.
Yeah, I know, it's
it works. Like it's, and I think like the people that I think the 7-1 split is amazing.
It works for Canada at the last in the Women's World Cup, got them into the semifinals. So we knew it worked already.
We knew it worked too.
But you know, we have to let the world catch up sometimes. Yeah, exactly. You know, this is the problem when you just watch the men's rugby, you miss all the incredible stuff going on in the women's game, and then you see clearly Razzie Erasmus was watching that and going, actually, this is,
I was just gonna say that's what it is. Razzie Erasmus is watching the Canadian women's team.
That's the only explanation it is, that it could possibly be.
Or the other explanation is that it works. It's really but I think like part of the criticism, it's like part of what makes it great too, is it's like no other team in the world could do that. Like no other, like, I mean, maybe you could do it, but no other team feels like you can do it this effectively. Like, I made that joke earlier in the World Cup that I was like, the best pack in the world is South Africa. The second best pack is South Africa's bench. Right.
Yeah.
And it kind of came through, and you look at like what this game ultimately came down to was they had to win a scrum. Right.
Yeah.
And the bomb squad showed up and won that scrum. Right. And they all could, every single one of those seven forwards that was on the bench contributed mightily to the game. And I think like that's part of what's so great too, is it's like you look at the team and they got some superstars in that pack. Like obviously like Sia Khaleesi, Evan Etzebeth, right? And all of them are perfectly okay with like being pulled out of the World Cup final, because that's the best thing for the team, right? And it's like no other team does this. No other team's like, we're gonna take our captain off in the biggest game, right? No, like but South Africa does it because that works. And it's like the backs go in knowing like there's nobody on the bench for us. The biggest criticism of the 7-1 split when they first started doing it was like, oh, like what if a back gets hurt? Well, what if they don't?
Exactly.
What if they don't?
I mean, the first player that got subbed for South Africa was Benampi, who is the hooker.
And hooker, 3 minutes into the game. And guess what? Yeah. You had another hooker on the bench. It's
I mean, and he played, worked out.
He played almost 80, but he played like 78 minutes or whenever.
Yeah, 76 or so. But, one thing I want to mention is that I think the refereeing was superb for this game. Wayne Barnes, already an excellent referee. This is his first World Cup final.
He had one screw up.
I think, this is the thing. Because I've seen people say like, oh, he had the screw up with Ardie Sevilla.
Ardie Sevilla calls.
Ardie Sevilla, he got that wrong. And he, from what he saw, it was he thought he'd come in at the side, and then like Tom Foley, the TMO, didn't correct him or anything, and South Africa take the penalty, they get it, and they win by 1 point. And you can turn around and say that's that could have been, that is a deciding factor. However, it is also worth mentioning that New Zealand missed their conversion a separate penalty. So I'm not saying Wayne Barnes is the reason South Africa won. I'm not accepting that excuse anyone says. It were, you could say like New Zealand's ill discipline cost them. Obviously, Sam Kane's red card. Shannon Frizzell getting a yellow as well. But then again, that was the issue with South Africa. You know, it's like both captains getting a card. Siya Kolisi having a bit of a head knock, and you know, we're not. It's like, oh, is he going to be red carded as well? Kolbe getting a yellow card with less than 10 minutes to go.
Oh man,
which set up that penalty. Which
that's going to be an iconic image of him just like turtling in his jersey. On the
he was heartbroken.
He knew that if
that penalty had gone through, he would have to like get a French passport as soon as possible, change it into Cheslin Colbert, and like never return to South Africa again. Obviously it worked out for him in the end. So
to me, though, with the Sevilla call, is that what I don't and. Like what I just don't understand about the situation is it's like the issue that I have is that Wayne Barnes, before the kick happens, I guess sees a replay of it in the stadium and then tells Sevilla that he's sorry and he got it wrong. And I'm like, at that point, like, why can't we just like, we can
call it back and
we can call back. We call back tries for forward passes that happened 70 meters ago.
Yeah.
Right. But we can't call that, like, we can't, like, oh, whoops, and like reverse that. Cause that's cause it's like New Zealand had a try called back because Barnes missed a knock on.
Yeah.
Right. Which happens all the time. That's not a knock on Barnes. That happens all the time. Right. That's why we have TMO. So the TMO is like, oh, hey, call that try back because there's a knock on. Right. And that would have led to that because that knock on ultimately leads to a scoring play. But it's like when it's that penalty led to 3 points directly. But like, but before the kick even happens, Wayne Barnes is like, oh, hey, I screwed that up. And I'm like, well, if we screwed that up, and maybe there's a thing in the rules, in the laws, sorry, maybe there's a thing in the laws that's like once that penalty's called, like that, you can't review that, you can't call that back, which is fair. But then, I mean, I know there's like the respect the referee and everything in rugby, but maybe just keep that one to yourself. Apologize after the game. Maybe, you know, like, because it's weird to have the ref say on the mic that he got that call wrong and apologize for it and then still let them kick. And that, and even if I completely agree with you, the All Blacks definitely had chances and it's not the deciding factor in the game, but on the scoreboard, that was 3 points. They won by one. So it adds up like that.
Yeah.
But I do agree with you. There was obviously like Barrett's kick obviously missed. And that's, you know, that sucks too. But as you said, like they had a couple opportunities with lineouts and things. Obviously, as you said, like South Africa doesn't allow tries in the World Cup finals very often. Right. And their defense was kind of the story again. Right. PSTD absolutely balled out in this game. He was incredible. I think he had like, what, 28 tackles?
Yeah.
Like 28 tackles was immense in the breakdown. He was the only forward that doesn't come off. And he played like he's the only forward that's not going to come off as well. And I thought he was immense. And he just kind of like led the way. All their tackling was superb. Their lineout defense was incredible. Their scrum was great. It was a pretty typical South African game. Their defense is going to play flawlessly. You're not going to get much. And if you make a mistake, they'll make you pay for it. Even if it's just Pollard slotting penalties. And he's like, Pollard was like, what, like 100% through the World Cup? It's incredible too.
Yeah.
It's a pretty unreal game for South Africa. It's interesting too, though, how like both games, the bronze and the gold, both kind of came down to a guy missing a kick late in the game. I had issue with Argentina's. Go for the win, boys. Go, don't tie. go for the win. Because whenever we talk about that and that comes up, people are like, oh, like, but you can go for the try later. And it's like, everyone's like, well, if you go for the try and you miss the try, then you get nothing. And it's like, this was the once, this is a situation where like, well, what if you miss the kick too? Like, you can miss way.
Well, if there's any team that knows that kicking to the corner and it not working out in a World Cup, it's definitely England.
Yeah.
So I think they had a bit of sympathy. But ultimately, that's, you know, it's happened, you know, incredibly close final. Congratulations again to South Africa. Congratulations to England for getting the bronze. Commiserations to New Zealand and Argentina.
I got one more thing on this, though.
One last thing. Come on.
At least as far as like I started playing rugby in 2007, which is really like the first time I like got into rugby or even heard of the sport, really. And ever since then, I've always been like, everyone's always been like the All Blacks are the best team, like historically. Did the Springboks just take that from them? With the fourth World Cup now, they've played in two less World Cups. One of New Zealand's World Cup win doesn't even South Africa didn't play in it. Like, is South Africa like, when do we start like that switch? Is that switch happening, or do we still give it to New Zealand because of, you know, they obviously dominated for a long time before the World Cups were even a thing, and you know. Some of those Dan Carter, Richie McCaw teams that were between World Cups too were some of the best teams ever. But it's statistically four World Cups and you played in two less so than everybody as well.
Two fewer.
Oh, would it be the grammar police now, Stu?
Yeah, you gotta know. Come on, you need to know what you're talking about. I think that New Zealand between 2011, 2015 were just unrecognizable. They were the cream of the crop. There was nothing that really, they're the first men's professional team to go an entire year unbeaten.
Yeah.
They set the standard for South Africa to reach. And we also got to remember in that time, I would say like 2014 to 2016, South Africa were just
trash.
The game against Japan was obviously the big thing of 2015. 2016,
they got to the final four of that World Cup, though. Everybody kind of forgets that.
Yeah, they did.
They got to the final four of that World Cup. They lost to Japan, yeah, but they still got there.
Yeah, I think they were like, oh, we cannot slack off at any other point now in this competition. Yeah,
they've done literally nothing but win since
20. Yeah, I think from
since that game, though.
I don't know. From 2017, I'd say.
Yeah.
Is more accurate. 2016, they did the end of the year tour of Europe and got whitewashed for the first time in their history.
Yeah, they were bad.
I even made a joke that the Springbok is now extinct after being hunted in across Europe.
Yeah, that joke aged well.
Well, it was, especially that year. But no, obviously they've Razzy Erasmus turned it around for 2019. His move to director of rugby has obviously helped where they go from here, and with the expanded World Cup in Australia in 4 years' time, we've yet to see. Remember, a lot of these guys, this is their final swan song for both teams. Like Sia Khaleesi is 32, I believe. So it's very likely that this may be his final World Cup. A lot of these guys,
he's got one more in him.
Yeah, but not as a starter, I'd say.
A lot of All Blacks, Aaron Smith, Sam Whitelock. There's a whole bunch that are hanging him up.
Yeah, loads of guys are hanging up the boots. Like we said, for both teams. So, you know, we've got to see what the new crop of players coming in the next World Cup cycle. But yeah, I think obviously every single team has players that are saying like, oh, I'll retire after the World Cup. You know, we've had it with Ireland with Johnny Sexton. We've had it with Wales with Dan Biggar and England with Johnny May as well. A load of guys, Courtney Laws as well, Ben Youngs. So
it's going to be weird watching rugby without all these guys.
I know, but that's the nature of the game. You just you don't own the jersey. You just you look after it until you pass it on. But right, I know it's a Canadian rugby podcast. We've talked about the biggest event in men's rugby, but let's bring it back to the Canadian side of things. Let's bring it back to Toronto because we've got a bit of news coming about the Toronto Arrows. First of all, Noel Reid and Peter Nelson have officially re-signed for the 2024 season. And it was announced today that Robbie Povey has officially signed for 2024 as well. So, you know, Povey and Nelson, fly half, fullback, take your pick really of that situation. Noel Reid, mainly center, but has had some experience of kicking. So I think now we have Nelson, Povey, Malcolm, Reid, you know, four guys that are able to kick during the games. Hopefully Reid is a little bit healthier this season, not picking up as many injuries as he did last year. It'll be great to see him back. Nelson as well. Povey, I mean, if you're an Arrows fan, then you obviously saw Sabercats come and get a win last season, mainly thanks to the boot of Povey. So maybe he can do that for our team instead this year. Maybe we will see.
Povey was very good for Houston last year. I mean, they had Davey Cotier as a fly half as well, so he came off the bench or played when Cotier was hurt. But in that time there, he was really good. Had a couple some big try games as well, and
he did picked up a couple and adding to his try record as well. He did, when we did have the chance to interview him after that game, he did say he had been injured earlier that season as well, which had prevented him having to his. I keep forgetting that he has four caps for the Utah Warriors. Just completely.
Because
he's just become synonymous with Houston.
Yeah, he was there for there's a couple players. It's Hank Stevenson is probably my favorite random Utah Warrior. Hank Stevenson, Quatrin, random Utah Warrior, as well. So Stevenson was at least on the roster for a bit, even though we didn't play. Quatrin, I don't even think ever actually got to Utah.
I don't think he got to Utah, because as soon as it was announced that the Arrows had traded in for him, it was then New England have received him instead.
I hope the Utah fans gave Andrew a nice warm reception when he got back there for the first home game as a free, or first away game as a member of the Free Jacks. I'm sure it was a special moment for him.
Absolutely. But the big news that has come out in the Arrows camp is that they have their new head coach, which is Australian Stephen Meehan. Yeah. Now, if you're a fan of Bath or Stade Francais.
Nobody's a fan of Bath.
Well, I think we have a big following in Bath, so I think they're very offended you just said that. But he has quite the resume. So after starting his coaching journey in the late 1990s, he eventually moved to France in 2002, where he was the assistant coach at Stade Francais, during which time they won the top 14 championship in 2003 and 2004, as well as reaching the Champions Cup finals in 2005. From there, he was originally meant to be an assistant coach, but then became the head coach at Bath between 2006 to 2011, during which time they won the European Challenge Cup in 2008. He then moved back to Australia in 2013 to become the attack coach at Western Force. He then traded to the Queensland Reds to become their attack coach. Then he became the backs coach for Toulon in 2015-2016 during their huge Galacticos era. Then he became the backs coach in Japan for the Kintetsu Liners before returning to Australia to become the defense coach this time for the Western Force, and before becoming the director of rugby at GPS Rugby Club in Brisbane. And now he is the head coach for the Toronto Arrows. So his first time in North America, but quite the resume that he brings to the club, don't you think?
Yeah, like, I mean, just listening to you rifle off the teams he's coached, and you know, it's obviously a very impressive resume. I really like the signing from Tim Matthews as well. Like, it seems like, you know, look, as you said, like, looking at his resume here, he's got some head coaching experience, right? And a director of rugby experience, but also like, and a whole bunch of like assistant coaches, attacks, back coach type stuff. In some of, you know, in the top 14, in the Premiership, in Super Rugby, like the best leagues in the world. As you mentioned, he's been part of championship teams in these leagues as well, right? And in the years that he didn't win, his teams went really deep during those seasons and those individual campaigns, right? So it's like, he seems like he's bringing a wealth of experience. And, you know, you kind of, like, one of the things that's like, I'm kind of looking at here, obviously head coach at Bath is, you know, like that's a really big deal. Head coach of a Premiership team, right? Like, that's obviously an incredibly big deal, but head coach obviously covers a lot of ground, a lot of area, right? Defense, attack, you know, forwards, backs, you oversee everything, right? His assistant coaching jobs really kind of jump out at me a little bit as well, though, because it's like, it's mostly attack coach and backs coach. So attack coach for the Western Force, attack coach for Queensland Reds, back coach for RC Toulon, backs coach for the Liners in Japan, then back to defense coach for the Force. But I'm kind of like looking at that and being like, okay, so the Arrows just hired a guy that has been an attack coach in some of the best leagues in the world, obviously also a head coach. But when he's not a head coach, it seems like attack is his thing, right? And the Arrows couldn't score last year. If there was a glaring, I mean, they finished 113-2, but if there was a glaring flaw in that team, it was that they could not score. Right? And it seems like hiring a guy that brings in the wealth of experience that he has in like the leagues that he's played in, but also when he's not a head coach, seems to be more focused on attack in most of those roles. There is the one defense coach job there, but in most of his assistant coaching roles seems to be the attack and backs guy. I think that's a really positive thing for a team that had 306 points last year, which was last in the Eastern Conference and only better than the 278 points scored by the Dallas Jackals, who, if you need a refresh on the standings, are also not very good. So I think hiring a guy that maybe, you know, likes a little bit of the attacking side of the game, right, and has that high level experience, I think is a really good thing. When I was kind of like looking him up, I was like, I kind of want to check out, like, because obviously he played on he's coached some crazy teams. And it's like, if you pull up like the 2016 RC Toulon roster, like that he coached, this squad is insane. Right. So like, it's just to kind of illustrate like the level of experience, that like he's bringing, it's like, these are like the guys, some of the names, the guys that he coached, just kind of scrolling through this roster here. You got Paul O'Connell, Stefan Armitage, Mamuka Gorgadze, Juan Smith, Juan Martin Fernandez, Samu Manoa, Dwayne Vermeulen. Who else do we got here? Quade Cooper, Matt Gitto,
Brian Habana.
Matthew Bassi, yeah, Brian Habana, yeah, he's pretty good. Ma Nanu, I think he's some guy that plays for San Diego now. Drew Mitchell, he's some guy that was supposed to play for LA at some point, I think. Weird amount of like MLR connections on this squad, if I must say. Bastero's there too. Giddo's obviously there. It's very bizarre. Lee Halfpenny as well, just to give you a little bit of a Welsh shout out there. I'm sure I'm missing a couple of guys. This roster is stacked, but like, I just kind of wanted to run through that, 'cause I'm like, that's an example of like the dudes that this guy coaches or has coached like throughout his career. Right. And like, so like, I mean, just to break that down, if you're telling me that we just hired Brian Habana's attack coach, I'm sold. I'm sold on it. I hope it does well. I mean, I think I think I hope he goes well. I'm excited to see what his brand of rugby is going to look like, what he wants to do. Obviously, too, what is I think also kind of interesting with that is Corey Hector. We talked about being promoted from the as the academy coach back up to the Arrows MLR staff.
Yeah.
And when before the academy was a thing, Hector was part of the Arrows coaching staff in the MLR, where he was the attack coach. Right. Yeah. So it seems like a couple of these coaches signings really, like, obviously as a GM, I think if you're Tim Matthews, you want to use the players that you want to sign, players that address maybe holes that the roster had last year. Where you see fit, you're going to go try to sign guys that fill those gaps, you know, depending on what you feel like you need. But I also kind of think that applies to coaches and stuff that you bring in too. And right now it's kind of like, well, they finished at the bottom, like, they finished basically like 11th out of 12 teams in points scored last year, right? Yeah. Last in their conference. And there was a lot of games where we were kind of like, like, how many times did we come on the show last year talking about, like, oh, like, they had an opportunity from 5 minutes out and they missed it? Or
no, that's also just been last, like, the season just gone. That's been for, like, the past few years.
Right. So,
it's cool that you're, like, within 5 meters, but you need to get over
you need to get past
the tie line.
5 meters. Yeah. And I think, like, that was a topic of conversation we had almost weekly on the show, was going through plays where we felt that the Arrows missed an opportunity for tries, right? And I think, like, just kind of looking at the resume, I love seeing the head coach and the head coaching roles, the director of rugby roles. I think he's going to bring a lot of that. But I am fascinated by the fact that most of his, like, assistant coaching roles all seem to be, at least when it actually, the title has the word attack in it. Right. Yeah. Like, which I think is a bit of a fascinating thing. Right. So I think that might seem like, hey, like, that's kind of maybe addressing a little bit of the fact that, hey, we didn't score a lot last year. We got to change that. So, like, the signing, I'm excited to see how the Arrows look going forward.
Obviously a huge signing with Meehan as head coach. But when we come to the Arrows, we currently have on the roster in the forwards, we have Mucker Rogers, Roland, Larson, Grindle, Flesh, and O'Neill. In the backs now, Brown, Malcolm, Richardson, Breen, Bowman, Bowen, Grant, Reed, Nelson, and Povey. Now, we still have the trades of Biddle, Jay Brown, and Waitakia. Those haven't officially been announced yet, but obviously if Povey's been announced, those names seem to be coming along as well. And we still have those 9 foreign player slots for the Arrows for the 2024 season. But there has been activity for Canadians around MLR as well. We've had a few signings. So Gabe Casey, draft for New England, as signed for the team, as well as
former Arrows draft pick as well.
Yeah, but I think he has to actually play for the Arrows as well.
Well, he's not drafted by them.
That is true. Anyway, Cameron Nordley Kalametti, scrum half, and Piers Von Dazelden, a lock, have also signed for New England as well. So, you know, really seeing that having Canadians on their squad helped last year secure the Shield. So continuing where they are, but they have made some space for those Canadians because they have done a trade with LA, ATL, whichever team you want to call them. Regan O'Gorman joined Rugby LA, with New England receiving LA's second round pick in the 2024 draft, as well as salary cap space. And Spencer Jones will join Utah, with New England receiving Utah's first round pick in 2024 draft, as well as extra salary cap space on top of that. So, you know, 3 Canadians coming in because Nordley Kalameni is Canadian eligible through adoption. So overall, plus 1 Canadians for New England in 2024. But Regan O'Gorman joining LA, Spencer Jones joining Utah. Yeah, well, first of all, I think there's a criminal lack of Canadians in Utah anyway. So, You know, we have Emerson Pryor. Emerson
Pryor gets some friends now, yeah.
Yeah, I need an extra connection. But that's the thing we keep saying to all these American-based MLR teams, is that if you want to make it to the final, if you want to win the Shield, you need to have more Canadians than the other team. And obviously, Toronto has all the Canadians. But, you know, there's still some Canadian players out there as well.
The American team with the most Canadians then win the Shield for the fourth time.
Yeah, exactly. So
for the fourth time, I think. Yeah,
the numbers don't lie.
For the third time, both Seattle, LA didn't have the most Canadians. I don't think, but they had a lot. And yeah, so the third.
I think they did.
Did they? I don't know.
There's DDA.
Yeah, there's a lot of Canadians on that team.
Anyway, Canadians win Shields. There you go.
So, yeah, hopefully that translates to the Toronto Arrows soon. Yeah, so some great moves from New England. I hate the fact that they seem like they're getting better somehow. This is terrifying. I first saw like O'Gorman and Jones getting traded out, and I was kind of like, yeah, it feels like it's to be expected, right? Like whenever you win a championship, we've seen it in literally every sport that has a salary cap, right? It's like the year after you win, it's hard to keep the team together. In a salary cap league, right? Because guys obviously perform really well, and if their deals are expiring, they want more money.
They won the Shield. They're good. So
because of that, exactly. It happens in every sport, right? It's like guys end up moving on. Guys are going to get traded. Guys are going to sign elsewhere as free agents. Right? It just happens with every team. So I kind of, when I saw O'Gorman and Jones get traded away, you know, I think I was kind of sad to see them leave New England, but also like I just expected that to happen. And then they brought in Piers von Dadelson is obviously the direct replacement for Regan O'Gorman. And then Nordli Kelametti doesn't play the same position as Spencer Jones, but that is the back replacement. And, you know, cool to see Gabe Casey get locked up as well after, you know, this is, as we kind of joked about earlier, the second team that he's been drafted by. So nice to see him sticking with New England there. Jason Patras, obviously the reigning MVP in MLR, is the fly half there. So I doubt he's going to get too many starts. But it's a pretty cool player to be able to kind of learn under, right? So I'm sure that'll be exciting for Casey there. Kind of wild seeing what New England's been doing. Non-Canadian New England signings too. They signed Martin Segrin, who knocked Canada out of the World Cup. So we know how good he is. And he had a great World Cup himself. He's been one of Chile's best players over the past like 3 years, right? So that's also, as a fan of a different Eastern Conference team, that is concerning as well, because I really don't like the fact that the Free Jacks seem like they are getting better somehow. This feels concerning as another Eastern Conference fan.
Yeah, well, something else that a Free Jack has been up to has been training with a English Premiership side, Ben Lesage.
Yeah,
as it's been revealed to Neil Davidson, has been with Gloucester following the tour to Tonga. He's not officially signed in like any capacity. Mm. It's more that he's like the medical joker whilst players have been at the World Cup, so it's more than likely that is coming to a close. But, you know, obviously great experience of with New England and Gloucester already having ties together. Wayne Conradi played for Gloucester before he joined New England. Jack Reeves played for New England two seasons ago and played in Gloucester this past season.
He's still there. He's playing right now.
Yeah. Well, I think it was on like he played for the Free Jacks, went back to play for Gloucester just to cover, because I think he was on a loan from Gloucester to the Free Jacks, then just kept scoring tries, and Gloucester were like, yeah, we'll keep him around. He seems all right.
That's usually the way to every team's heart is score some tries.
Yeah. But let's talk about the 2024 season, because there's been a few rumors spinning around. And we have this information from America's Rugby News, as well as the most recent edition of MLR Weekly, which is that the 2024 season will begin 2 weeks later than it did in 2023, with a, you know, the first weekend of March will be the kickoff.
Mm-hmm.
And this main, and apparently this is done to alleviate some concerns with the weather for the northern based teams. But in the ARN article, it says it will also necessitate a 2 week pause in the season during the playoffs, no less, to accommodate the July international window. Then it goes on to say there's going to be a shakeup in the league structure itself. With ARN saying multiple sources have indicated there will be three conferences instead of two. And the conferences or divisions, whatever you want to call them, will be divided into the West, the Central, and East Conference. West will contain Seattle, San Diego, Los Angeles, and Utah. Central, Chicago, NOLA, Houston, and Dallas. And the East will have Toronto, New York, New England, DC, and Miami. There's no indication of what the playoff, the season structure or the playoff structure is at the moment. If I'm going to hazard a guess, obviously having 13 teams, it's not really divisible in any way. It's a prime number. It's odd as well. But my guess is that they'll try and keep having 16 games per team for the entire season. So in this case, Toronto have four other teams in the Eastern Conference. And if they do home and away fixtures, that'll leave eight games. And then they'll take two teams from the Central Conference, play those at home. The other two they'll play away. That brings it to 12. And then same thing with the West. That'll take it to 16. What the West and Central will do to make up those numbers, I've yet to see. Maybe another...
That's the same thing.
Internal conference fixture or something. But
it'd be the same thing as last time was at 13, right? You just have the other uneven ones. Just play the extra games. Playoff structure would be interesting. There's a lot. I think there's a lot you can kind of do with that. Logic would indicate the top three teams make it. And then I guess depending on how many teams you actually want to have in the playoffs, would determine how many other teams actually get in, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, I guess if you want to go six, you can maybe just do the top two teams in each division. But then you're going to need buys. So how do you determine who has the top two buys? I guess that's full league-wide standings. I feel like there's a lot of options there. And you can kind of go with that. I feel like just looking at this, that's probably going to save the league some money on travel.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, right? Like, I mean, it's no different than every other sports league in North America, right? Like, conferences and divisions exist for travel costs, really. And for both cost and time, right? Like, that's a big reason why basically why every other sports league has a conference division set up. So I don't know. I think that's interesting. And if that ends up happening, I'd be into it. I'm curious to see how that happens. I think Toronto is getting a little screwed in this division alignment, because those are the three best teams from the Eastern Conference, plus the expansion team Miami. So we have all three teams that made the playoffs in the Eastern Conference last year in our division, I guess. So that's fun. But other than that, I think the playoff, I think I like the three team format, or the three conference format. If they do go to that, I think it makes some sense. I'm curious to see what the playoff structure is, but I think it does make sense. What do you think, Stu? And I'll circle back to the thing that I hate that you just talked about.
I think it, like you said, you know, saves on travel time. I'm pretty sure that, like, once we get to 16 teams, we'll, you know, do like four conferences of four and we'll change the entire format again. You know, as we aim towards the 2031 Men's Rugby World Cup. There's going to be more interest in the sport. There's going to be hopefully more fans coming along. It's going to be marketed out as being like, oh, these are the American players. These are the North American players. These are the Canadians that will be at that World Cup. Knock wood. And then it's the whole structure of, you know, it's going to change.
It evolves.
In the same way that when the league started, it wasn't going to remain as seven teams.
And this is what, year season seven we're going into, right? Yeah, seven.
Yeah.
Math can't be this hard. But either way, like, how many years have we had with the same format being used in back-to-back years? 2020, 2021? Because there was no new teams out of the pandemic. Actually, no, LA was new out of the pandemic.
Right? LA, so it was 12 in 2020, 13 in 21.
Yeah, back
12
down.
In 22, ooh. And 12 in 23.
Three. Yeah, but in 23, they added the conferences. Right? When is
they had the conferences in 2020.
Yeah, but they changed the playoff format. They changed the playoff format. They added two more teams making the playoffs.
Oh, yeah. In 2020, it was going to be a six-team playoff format. Obviously, that never happened.
Yeah.
Then in 2021, it was four teams. Then they expanded it to six, which they did for 22 and 23. Okay. So I think it's, just those. Yeah,
okay,
just
so 22, 23, it would have been the same. Okay, so it's only been the same. Well, there you go. So we're on year seven. It's only been the same back-to-back years once, right? So
yeah,
it's obviously going to keep evolving. I do kind of like, I think the three-team one might be interesting too, though, because it does kind of feel like obviously Chicago, NOLA, Houston, Dallas as a central division makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Like I think that kind of makes sense a little bit. It's also interesting because it's like, if you have, it does kind of leave a bit, it's interesting looking at it because I'm like, I feel like that leaves room to expand to 15 teams and not have to tweak it that much.
Like, yeah, it just depends where those
two
extra teams are going to go.
Well, then you would just, no matter where they go, you have three divisions of five teams. Right.
Like, yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, no matter where they end up.
Travel arrangements, you just have to work out.
It doesn't matter where they end up being. You would just, you can easily fill in two divisions of five teams.
The 2 week break?
Yeah, don't like that. Starting the season a little bit later in March, I guess that's cool. Like, I mean, I know it seems like the MLR is allergic to snow and will try to do everything possible to avoid snow games, even though they happen. It's tough because there's obviously the July test window, and I'm kind of like, you don't want to mess with it. You can't do anything about the July test window, right? You're gonna have to release players for international duty, Canadians, Americans, you know, Uruguayans will probably have to go. Chileans are going to have to go. Namibians will have to go. You know, maybe a select few Argentinians, some of the Miami guys, maybe. But it's like taking a 2 week break in the playoffs just feels like it would absolutely derail like any momentum the season has to me.
I'm more of a case of like when it happens, well, no, because I'm pretty sure like Super Rugby in like New Zealand, Australia, and even South Africa back when it was, they would have their season, then they would have their tours come, and then they would have the playoffs.
It's such a significant like break, like. But it's also going to be like, man, like, I don't know. Like, if I'm an Arrows fan too, like, And say, like, there's Arrows players that go to play internationals and then also get hurt at the internationals, and then now the Arrows don't have them for the playoffs.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's, like, I think that's, a like, another slight concern with that, too, right? You know, obviously, I mean, obviously from, like, I guess the Rugby Canada or any of the international teams' point of views is, well, the players can get hurt in the MLR and then they're not available yeah. for the internationals.
And so that's the, and just to reiterate to our listeners from you, this is not confirmed. This is just rumors.
Well, yeah. when I mean, something it's a pretty trustworthy source, though.
It's that is true, but until something official comes from the league, then we can't confirm it. This is
I just,
true. But it's I think more though, than likely that this will happen.
Like, the thing is it's like, I don't know. I just think, like, if you have, like, all this momentum building up, because the way the America's Rugby News article is worded is it says it's a 2-week break during the playoffs, right? Like, that's the word that he uses, right? It's not before the playoffs. It's during the playoffs.
Yeah. Right? But it's also as well, like, is that, especially with the Pacific Nations Cup expansion that was announced last week, is saying that it guarantees teams will have 3 games. So
I don't know. Like, that's the other thing. Like, hey, maybe you play, like, I don't know, maybe you play, like, the semifinals, and then, like, is that just gonna be the final is gonna happen after the July test? See, because I think that's the thing, that's like the MLR season got moved to where it was to avoid the July test window, right? Because it is kind of complicated. And like, I'm not really sure what you really do about this. Like, I would almost, like, it's weird because it's like, I would almost rather see them, like, start in, like, April, have players leave for the test window in the middle of the season, right? And then have everybody come back and have the playoffs in, like, I don't know, August or something, or it's August, September. But then that conflicts with the NFL, right? And if you can't conflict anything with the NFL, right? So, like, that's the whole point of why the season starts. Like, the season is in that specific window, I feel like, for a bit of a reason, right? And I'm like, I'm just, like, thinking, like, too, like, if for all those MLR players that are going to have to go play at the international test, that's a lot of rugby in July for all of those guys, right? You're going to have to go play your MLR season. You're not going to get any break. You're going to have to go immediately to go play test rugby, come back and play in the biggest games of the season. Like, right. And be expected to perform at your highest level in those games too. Like, that's a lot to ask, I think. I think, like, part of it is just like, I mean, if you're going to, like, there's a small part of me that's just like, if you're going to have teams in Chicago, Toronto, New England, Utah, you might have to just accept the fact that it might snow once in a while, or it might be cold.
Yeah.
And, like, I think too, like, if you go through it, I think that's also part of the fun of, like, North American sports leagues as well, right? Is, like, home field advantage is a thing, right? Like, you look at teams, like, you look in the NFL, right? Teams like the Bills or the Packers or the Bears get a little bit of an advantage on a team like LA or Miami or Dallas when those Southern teams have to come up and play in the middle of December in Green Bay, right? Like, it's not fun for, like, the guys that normally spend all their time in Miami to come up and play in the freezing cold. And they're probably going to lose because of that, right? Like, it's kind of like, you, like, I think it, like, if you're a cold weather team, maybe you can just relish in the fact that you're a cold weather team, right? And be like, maybe try to beat some teams and stuff. The one thing I do kind of like about it, though, is if it does get rid of the super, like, if I like the idea of getting rid of the super, like, road loaded front half of the season. For the Arrows specifically, but for all the Northern teams. But also, I think you can do that if you're just willing to. And I don't know, I'm not a professional rugby player, so maybe all the actual guys that play in this league are screaming at me right now. But, like, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I don't like the taking a break during the playoffs, and I'm trying to avoid that. And my solution is just like, I don't know. Maybe we got to play in the cold and just deal with it. Like, it might be cold in February and early, like, because honestly, like a March 2nd date, it's still cold. It's still going to be cold. So, I mean, like, just, I don't, I think we should keep the season where it is. To avoid that test window. I don't want to see the best players in the league gone at the best time of the year for the season, but also to see the season lose all momentum because we have to stop for 2 weeks or even as you suggested, Stu, 3 weeks if it's the full duration of that tournament, right? In the playoffs. It just feels like it'll kill momentum. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's like I'm trying to make the best of like a bad situation. I mean, look, the Eastern Conference, four of the teams are in like the Arctic swell between like January to March. Chicago as well had freezing rain when the Arrows came to play. Utah, they've been known to have snow on their games. Houston and Dallas,
yeah,
also had.
Colorado cold winter, whole snow games when they were
exactly. And
yeah,
when we had Tim Matthews and Bill Webb on last year, when we were saying like, oh, if you could pick a team, they were saying, you know, somewhere that's warm so that you can actually play. Yeah. And you know, it's for them, it's also, oh, we want to play somewhere warm, but we also want to play somewhere that's, you know, got the infrastructure to play, which will, and as well as like the infrastructure for fans to attend as well. Yeah. And a lot of those are in like the northeast of the United States. And, you know, it's, yeah, I can understand where the league's coming from, is that if this is what they're going to do, having the, ideally, what I would like to see is that the regular season ends before the test window, and then it's,
the full playoffs after.
I think that would work well.
Yeah, I think if it's the full playoffs happen after the test window, I do like that a little bit more, right? But I believe the way correct me if I'm wrong, Stu, I don't have it pulled up in front of me, but like, I believe the America's Rugby News article said it would be during the playoffs, which to me just kind of feels like it's kills the momentum of the league.
The wording used is will also necessitate a 2-week pause in the season during the playoffs, no less. So
during the playoffs,
that's the thing. In the season and during the playoffs, those are two different times. There's the season or it's the postseason. So again, this is all speculation. There's been nothing announced of the schedule for 2024 or the structure of
pretty
the
reliable
season,
sources.
Yeah, but also there's no like saying how postseason qualification goes, how the postseason itself will go. So, you know, again, when we find that information out, we will let you know. All right, now we're going to be moving on to talk about the Canadian senior teams. We are going to head down to New Zealand because Canada played their third fixture against England this year. And, you know, it seems like history is repeating itself with, you know, we've had this game twice already. Just seemed to be a continuation. Final score, Canada 12, England 45. Again, there's a reason. They're the world number ones. And so, yeah, you know, a bit disappointing. I do not envy you if you didn't. Well, I wouldn't disagree with you if you decided to wait until it was reasonable hour o'clock.
I stayed up.
Watch the game. You stayed up, but not everyone can, is what I'm saying. It's just the deal with time differences and the Friday games in New Zealand. Ultimately, I'm not surprised by the results, in all honesty. But you know, from what I've seen, like Canada played exceptionally well. But ultimately, you know, one's a professional team that have professional capabilities, and the other's Canada. We've talked about this ad nauseum any time Canada has faced teams that do have a professional makeup. It's literally the nature of the difference between professional and amateur. And, you know, Davies was also phenomenal for England, picking up 4 tries. Kildon, Breach, and McDonald also adding to that tally. And even the, you know, you can't even say like, oh, the cards had something, because while, yeah, Atchison got yellow card in the 30th minute, Totosi picking up the try in the 31st. Yeah. You then add Shell picking up a yellow card herself in the 56th minute, which led to Davies' 4th try of the game. Although Farry's try has been like promoted on every rugby that channel that will allow it. Yeah, that was probably the try of the game if it keeps getting promoted that much on socials.
Oh yeah, that was definitely the best try of the game. The setup from Sue Manutafa as well was unreal. That's probably the best part of the try. Fairies totally turned on the afterburners after that turnover, but Seu Manutafa really kind of after the turnover really made that play happen, and Fairies did the rest. But yeah, definitely the best try of the game. All of England's tries were line-out mauls. Not exactly, I mean, they're good tries, they're good rugby plays, but not exactly highlight reel.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, obviously Lark Atkin-Davies being the hooker. Yeah, she's gonna
that's
pick
all 4 of those.
Yeah, she's gonna pick. Yeah, that's all. All 4, and then after she scores the last try, she's like, you know what? I'm going to let someone else do this, and Connie Powell comes on to take her place. Yeah. But it's like, if you score 2 and one player from the opposition can score 4, yeah, we kind of see where this is going. But again, you know, Sophie DeGoody on the mic after the game talking about like how, you know, Canada never gave up. They still kept going into the fight, even though it was a losing effort. But, you know, again, we've had this result twice already. Mm-hmm. Not much has happened apart from playing Wales in that time frame. So shouldn't be a surprise that it's obviously not as bad as it was during the warm-up games, but you know, could be better as well. But in the other WXV fixtures...
Okay, we're going to finish talking about this game first.
Right, come on, man, then get to it.
Yeah, so, like, I think this game, I think, comes down to, like, a couple of things. Like, you're saying, like, obviously, like, not much has changed or whatever. And obviously, you keep bringing up the pro versus amateur thing, and the unfortunate reality is, as much as we keep saying, like, yeah, we need more resources and everything to get to that professional level, still got to play England, still have to find a way to beat them, right? Like, Canada's knocking at the door of, you know, being a top club in the world, and the team ahead of them is England right now, right? So, got to figure out a way to beat them at some point. But, like, This game was pretty good. Like, it's a little bit better than what the scoreboard kind of indicates. Like, when the broadcast kind of showed the halftime stats, despite the fact that Canada was down 21-5, right? Like, there was a lot of stats that Canada actually looked like it kind of favored Canada a little bit. Canada had more possession, more territory, making more tackles or better tackles, right? Like, but there was a couple categories that obviously didn't go Canada's way. One of those was the set piece. Far too many lost lineouts, right? Whether that's from England stealing the lineout or from just an overthrow or a, you know, missed throw or a not straight throw, or some form of miscommunication or lack of execution that led to England coming away with the ball off the lineout. It happened far too often. But also, as you kind of mentioned, Stu, Atkin-Davies, 4 tries, again, all off the lineout. And you can kind of say that it's like Canada's penalty numbers were better than England's in this game. But England made Canada pay for every single one of their penalties, right? Which Canada didn't quite do in response. Right. And I think the lineup was a big area of this game where Canada just didn't match up with England. And that ultimately through whether that's through four defending the lineout, as England scored four of their tries through that lineout maul, right? Or just their own execution, because Canada had a couple chances that they missed out on as well, right? So that kind of adds up to it. You mentioned the yellow card where Totosi scored right after Aitchison's yellow, right? But then Canada gave up two converted tries during that yellow as well. So like the net score on that yellow card was 14-5 for England, which obviously bumped the score up to 21-5 for England at halftime. And then England kind of kept the ball rolling going into the second half. But that being said, though, there was a few things though that I really liked in this game. One, Sophie DeGoody kicking a lot more is pretty awesome to see, right? And you know, I think it kind of goes back to what our talk earlier about South Africa, right? Where I was saying like South Africa is just so unapologetically themselves, right? Like they play South African rugby, right? A lot of strong defense. They rock that 7-1 split on the bench. They just do everything super South African-y, right? And no other team in the world can really do what they do as far as the way they run their system, as far as the way they structure their lineup. And Canada, I think, with Sophie DeGoody and what she kind of showed in this game, I think also has that. Because there was a play in this game where Canada had a scrum in like the middle of the pitch, like 10 meters into their own half, right in the middle. And DeGoody runs a number eight pick, like a pick and go as the number eight out of the scrum, starts running towards like the English, the fly half there, who was Aitchison at the time, right? And as a normal, like number eight pick and go, but then instead of running into contact, she chipped a kick out to the winger, right? And the play ultimately didn't work. The ball went into touch. But that was a really cool play to see Canada run, because no other team in the world can run that play, right? Like no team has an eight that can kick like that. And it's something that watching the game, made me really like, even though Canada lost, kind of made me like really excited. And I hope like Kevin Rouet keeps implementing these types of things like in the attack and kind of keeps telling DeGoody to kick too. She tried a couple like 50-22s randomly as well, right? And it's like her skill set is such an asset that no other team has, right? So I think Canada's got to use it a lot more, obviously. And I think Canada's got to use it a lot more and help with it. I think it helps with the attack. You know, I thought, you know, the forwards were very good in the game. I mean, they kind of got outmatched at the lineout, but at the rucks and at the breakdowns, like they were good. Some of the backs were solid. Mentioned, Seyamu Tafa, earlier, she played really well, had a couple breakdown steals herself too, when she was called upon in defense. Right. So you got to definitely give her a shout out as well. And it's, you know, so I think overall it's a pretty good game. But I would like to see Canada kind of using Sophie DeGoody as that kicking option a little bit more, because like, even though it didn't necessarily always work out in this game, it's something that like, I don't think any other team really has. And then my final thought on this game is I hate Ellie Kildun. I mean that with all the respect in the world. It's just after playing against England for three times in a row, she's very annoying. And again, I mean that in the kindest, most complimentary way possible, coming from a Canadian fan, but starting to really, really bug me whenever I realize that she has the ball. So that's, I mean that fully complimentary sense, but I kind of hate her.
No, it's I get it. It's like it would be great if she suddenly found a Canadian passport and was like, you know, maybe I want to.
I hate her so much. I don't even want her on the team. Like, all right, yeah, she can stay in England. I want to continue to hate her.
All right, well, now you know how it feels for all of us when you talk about Saracens. Anyway, that's the other WXV1 games that took place this weekend. New Zealand played Wales. Wales scored a try. New Zealand scored a lot more. The final score, New Zealand 70, Wales 7. And then probably the most interesting result, especially after beating the Black Ferns last week, is that France struggled against Australia. The final score, France 20, Australia 29. So I don't know what's going on with France. Especially after pulling off that win to avenge their semi-final defeat last year. I was expecting them to be continuing, but it definitely opens the door for Canada, who will be playing France this Friday, Eastern time. Kickoff will be at 11 p.m. for us. So, not as late as 2 a.m., but it's a good thing it's going into the weekend. You don't have to worry about the boss being upset that you stayed up late or took a day off or anything like that. But that will mark Canada's last game for the women's for this year. But there are still two games to go for the men's, because we have the tallest of the 32 players for the men's tour to Spain, which will be kicking off this weekend as well. So from the list, we have 9 players from New England, 8 players from Toronto, 2 players each from San Diego and Dallas, 1 player each from DC, New York, Houston, and Seattle, and 3 from the Pacific Pride. And, there's a mix of, familiar faces, a mix of new guys coming in that Kingsley Jones has selected for this game. For the games against Spain and either Brazil or the USA. Derek, what do you make of the squad that's heading to Spain?
Yeah, I mean, nothing overly surprising, I guess.
It looks like, obviously some guys like Theo, there's a couple like Theo Richard, some of the Sevens guys didn't quite make it onto the squad, which isn't too surprising. Only 2 scrum halves, kind of interesting, with Higgins and Watkins. I guess last week you mentioned Ross Brody might be unavailable for some personal reasons, from the Neil Davidson article, so I guess that kind of explains that one. The back row, I kind of like back row, I find is pretty cool. Lucas Rumball, and then a whole bunch of really young players. Siaki Vikilani at 11 caps is the second most, seasoned of the back row players. So that's great. Second row too, a bit of the same thing. Bailey Flesh, Kelly Keys, right? So you got 2 vets, 2 young players. So, it seems like everywhere kind of has like the vet with the young guys as well. Only 2 hookers going. I hope that means we get to see DeWald Kotze get like a start in one of these 2 games. Again, because I'm, as we've said before, I am all for just letting the young guys play. In that same vein, Jamin Hodgkins, uncapped fly half, let him have a rip, Kingsley. Like, just let him go. Like, what's the worst that's gonna happen? Gabe Casey's also there. He's got 1 cap too. Right, Massage Richardson, Josh Thiel. That's a fun midfield again, with Lesage being vet and then a whole bunch of young guys. Like, we kind of have to, we kind of have to, right? Like, it should be turning the page. I like the fact that the team definitely leans younger. be cool to maybe have a guy from Europe or two, but I guess that's not going to happen anytime soon. Even Piers von Dadelson, I don't think even really counts as a guy from Europe now because he's a free jack. So it's, you know, we still still kind of got that those issues. But, I mean, the team skews younger. And, I mean, as much as I will criticize Kingsley Jones, I don't hate the fact that the team skews younger. Because I think that's what we should be focusing on right now. So, I don't know. No real issues from me, Stu. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a few absences that, you know, haven't been explained. Like we said, Spencer Jones wasn't even in the long list.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we do need to start gearing towards guys in their young know, early 20s and stuff like that. I mean, obviously you need to have like that bit of experience as well, but consider, you know, come 2027 or more accurately 2031,
yeah,
who's going to be playing, and you want to be giving those guys the most opportunities of all. Now, obviously, yeah, we talked about our opinions on Kingsley Jones remaining, yeah, as head coach, but you know, he does need to, you know, you did say before, like, he needs to win these games. He needs
to think he needs to win these games, yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'd also say, like, you need to get the young guys out there. You need to get them understanding what Test rugby is like and have them play and have them get used to being in that high-pressure environment. Trusting in themselves, trusting in their teammates. And yeah, and essentially just have that self-belief for what will be the biggest stage of their career. Yeah, it's good to see guys like Andrew Coe come back as well. He's been a notable absence for the past couple of years. Reed Watkins, you know, former Arrows player. There is a photo of him in an Arrows kit, therefore he is an Arrow. Even though he plays for Seattle at the moment. So it's great to see that he has the opportunity to win his first cap.
Mora's back too.
Yeah, Mora's back after picking up an injury that prevented him playing in the round sevens earlier this year.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we have guys like Jamin Hodgkins coming back from Cardiff Met. We also have, you know, young guys like Connor Young. Well, definitely, I mean, definitely a young guy if it's got Young in his name. But
I think ultimately, like, what I'm kind of looking for, though, like, out of the lineup, like, I don't, like, for example, I'm just gonna use the pack as an example, but I'm like, I don't want to see like a pack that's like Sears Duru, Quatrin, Keith, Bailey, Keys, Rumball, Vicalani. And I guess, well, I don't know, Juan Dadelson, I guess the back row kind of falls apart for this analogy because there's a lot of guys that only have.
Can I give a better example?
Sure.
I, as great as Kainoa Lloyd is, I don't want to see him start.
Yeah. Well, like that, that's kind of it. Like, I think I agree with that one too. I don't want to see like this team come out and it's all like the starting 15 is all like veteran guys.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I don't want to see that. And I mean, I just kind of, right, which I think you can kind of do for like, I don't know, Vicalani, I wouldn't necessarily consider a veteran, but he does have the second most caps of anybody on the back row. So, but at least through six guys, like there's like the forwards have six solid veteran Canadian players. The forwards, and I'm like, I don't want to see the pack with all six of them in it, right?
Yeah.
Similarly, like you said, same thing with like Kainoa Lloyd. Like, I don't need to see Peter Nelson that much. I don't think. Like, I'd rather see Povey and Hodgkins. Lesage is like, I think the midfield you could probably get away with playing anybody, and I'll be happy. Any combination of anybody there, and I'll be happy. But yeah, like, I would rather see like, I agree. Like, your outside backs, I'd rather see like Breen, Coe, Mora, or Olsen mixed in there.
Yeah, I was gonna say I'd rather see Olsen start than Lloyd, because we know what Lloyd's capable of.
Yeah,
we, as I like, he's the guy you want on the bench. He's the one who's gonna cover wing or center, or you know, you can then shuffle around and have him in. But you know, I don't want to see him start. But obviously, I'm not. But the
at the
head
same
coach.
Time, I'm kind of like, yeah, Kingsley Jones might want to win these games because we're all going to lose our minds if they keep losing with him as the coach. So,
well, we shall see. And speaking of see. Broadcast information has not been announced, but it it's probably going to be TSN or TSN Plus. And similarly, you can
YouTube. I don't know. It's been random with the men's team.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Well, then I don't know. But one thing we definitely know is that you can watch the WXV game between Canada and France. That will be available on TSN. If you're looking for other rugby this weekend, the Premiership in URC is available on Sportsnet. And if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out more as well as our written pieces on our website, LaRougeRugby.ca. You can find the podcast on Spotify, S4P, and Apple Podcasts. On our YouTube channel at LaRouge Rugby, we have episodes of the pod as well as extra interviews in our black box. So make sure to like and subscribe and hit the bell notification to stay up to date with all our videos. We're also available across social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Threads, all at LaRouge Rugby. Derek, where can the fine people find you on social media?
At Brissette the Jet across all social media platforms.
And you can find me across social media at Hardman, spelled H4RDMAN. Well, that's where we're going to end this episode. Derek, thanks for joining me. And thank you for joining us for another episode of La Rouge Rugby Podcast, where we talk about real Canadian rugby. We hope you can join us again next time.